Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thanksgiving isn't the only holiday where the young, the old, and the middling gather together, but somehow it's the one where the focus seems to be on the family. We ask about the kids, maybe catch up with the cousins. It's also a time to focus on the oldest members of the family, and that might include some difficult conversations about declining health, their living arrangements, even end-of-life issues. This hour on Point, Thanksgiving gratitude for aging family members and the conversation. You can join us on air or online. How's it going with your parents? Is it time to have that conversation? Is everybody in the family on board? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Baltimore is Ann Kaiser Stearns. She's professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. She's out with a new book called Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. And you can read an excerpt from that book on our website, onpointradio.org. And Ann Kaiser Stearns, good to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony. I hope you'll have a happy holiday weekend.
Well, the same to you and to all our listeners for that matter. And with me in the studio is Katie McGinnis Dietrich, and she's chair of the Older Adults and Families Concentration at the Boston College School of Social Work. She's also author of the textbook Social Work with Older Adults. And Katie McGinnis Dietrich, great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So I'll start with you, Katie, if I can. You know, let's start with this question. You know, how should families start to have this conversation if they haven't already?
And I'm assuming what you mean by the conversation in this case is about caregiving and who will take care of older adults.
That's right.
And I think any time there's even a small crisis or there's a health change is a good opportunity to have a conversation, to bring it up. I always think that it's a good idea to bring it up before you have a crisis, because if you have a crisis, no one is thinking straight. Everybody is feeling very, very defensive. So when older adults are feeling well and saying, I'd like to stay in my own house for another 10 or 12 years or 5 or 10, whatever the case, is a good time to have a conversation and say, what do you want? And if something happens, you know, what are the kinds of things that we're going to need to do anytime? But once again, I think the whole key is having the conversation before there's a crisis.
Before there's a crisis. And yet, I'm going to guess, and I don't know what the numbers would be, but knowing human nature the way it is, a lot of folks will put off that conversation until there's a crisis, right?
There's sort of a saying in the whole field of geriatric social work that everybody has a plan about when they get older, and that's that nothing will happen and everybody's wrong.
Yeah.
So I think most of the time, the reason I say that it's important to do it before the crisis happens is because most people don't have it until you have to make a life-changing decision about either getting specialized care or having people go to a higher level of supervised living.
Ann Kaiser Stearns, does that sound right to you? Get this conversation done before the crisis.
Yes, but I would want to say the worst possible time imaginable to have that conversation is during Thanksgiving holidays or the religious holidays that are coming ahead. What you want to do with these remaining holidays that you share that are so precious to families is make them as meaningful and rich and rewarding as possible. And it's so important to remember that even if a grandmother has significant impairment from, say, Alzheimer's, she's still there. There's still a person there who will respond to smiles and warmth and flowers and the patio and the turkey and the kindness of other people. So I think it's so important for us to make those holidays meaningful. We can tell the grandchild, for instance, you know, don't take it personally if grandmother doesn't remember your name or remember you. Just say, you know, I'm Sarah. I'm your granddaughter. I'm so glad to see you. I used to go visit my parents when they were living, and I would take pictures of my daughters for my mother to look at. And I would say, you know, I would show my two girls pictures when they were little and with their grandmother and then with me. And then I'd show them pictures of the current time, which when she had Alzheimer's, they were in college. And she would hold the pictures in her hand and she would say, oh, they're so pretty and you can tell they're smart too.
Yeah.
And then about an hour later, I'd do the exact same thing. And my mother would have forgotten that I had said that. And she would say the same thing of, oh, they're so pretty and you can tell they're smart too.
Sure.
Well, I loved hearing that over and over again. And I didn't care that she didn't remember. But it warmed her heart. It made her happy every time.
You know, I'm really glad you brought up the point that Thanksgiving may be precisely the time when you don't want to have these conversations. But it is a time when family members who might not have an opportunity to connect have that opportunity to connect. So in a way, they're able to sort of gather data and sort of share it. So don't have the conversation on Thanksgiving. But isn't this a sort of moment when families can kind of come together and sort of figure out what needs to be talked about, I don't know, after the holidays?
I wouldn't even bring those things up on the religious holidays or Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I really wouldn't, because what it can do is burn into the memories of each family member troublesome. These are troublesome, difficult topics.
Yeah.
When I wrote a letter to my daughters in the epilogue of my book, it was very hard for them to read, and I'm a healthy person. You know, those conversations are hard, even if everybody's healthy and nobody is old yet. But you don't want to ruin special family occasions by getting into those thorny topics.
Well, this sounds like a really important advice to take to heart on the eve of Thanksgiving. Katie McInnes-Dietrich, though, in terms of having this conversation ahead of time, what are the issues that families should really be thinking about if they're not already?
Well, one of the situations is sort of what is a plan B when an older adult or older couple gets to the point where they're really finding where they're living to be challenging, getting upstairs, maintenance around the home, sort of what might they consider to be the next thing and what kinds of supports. I think a second thing is that oftentimes whoever the lead sibling is identified, almost self-identified, that someone will start the conversation frequently, not always. Frequently, it's the oldest daughter, but not always. And sort of having the conversation about what might be the next steps if and when that happens. I think it's also the realistic idea. It's so easy to be in denial. I think when you're an adult child and your parents are getting older, and it's very difficult sometimes to watch that happen, especially with some cognitive decline. So I think having the conversation about we will be needing to make decisions, and at some point we like talk about advanced directives and what are the things that lie ahead of us, and sort of kicking family members out of denial into, you know, we can make these decisions together and we're going to need to work together and they won't be easy. Just a bond that can develop between siblings, which I think is critical.
Let's go to the phones right now and go to Bill, who's calling from Mount Pulaski, Illinois. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me. We went through this whole situation just very, very recently, as a matter of fact. My mother, unfortunately, had two strokes within 24 hours. Hmm. And so I was asked by my siblings. She lives out in Colorado. I was asked by my siblings to go out and help with her recovery. I happened to have some time off from work, so the timing just worked out. And I got out there thinking, here we are going to help Mom recover, do her therapies, and then she'll move on in her home. And I get out there, and it took about a week and a half, 2 weeks, for it to really dawn on me that, no, the decision had been made by my siblings that she's going to assisted living now, because obviously I don't live there. I can't care for her 24 hours a day, you know, and they have full-time jobs and can't be there to do that.
Right.
Right.
So the decision was made to put her into an assisted living facility. And how's that been working out?
Well, it left a very bitter taste in my mouth.
Hmm.
Because to me, the way these things should be happening, when someone has all their faculties, you need to sit down and have a conversation. Okay, these could be the constraints financially, physically, emotionally. These are the various options and what's the best choice, and then make a decision. But what happened here was the reverse of that. The decision was made, and now it's a game of talking mom into selling the house that she lived in for 43 years and going into assisted living.
Right. Bill, you've put a good issue on the table. I thank you for your call, and I wish your mother and the rest of your family well. Katie McGinnis, Dietrich, I want to ask you about that. I mean, there's sort of conventional wisdom that it's best to keep parents in their home or in their apartment for as long as possible. What do you hear in Bill's call there, and how do you do that?
I hear a couple of things. One is the dynamics that happen in families between siblings,
yeah,
and that decisions are made and the burden is borne in very different circumstances. I hear that. I also hear the fact that it's not headed towards a good place if the older adult is not considered as part of the decision, because they continue to be adults who have complete legal decision making. His mother could refuse to go, and there is nothing that would stop that. She has, with her, all of her faculties, has every legal right to not have to sell her home or not have to move. So I think it's not always the best, it's never the best thing to decide without involving the older adult and what that decision is,
right,
and what he or she sees as being what are they afraid of? What do they believe they can do? What are their fears? What can family members do? Because if the older adult themselves makes the decision, even if it's somewhat forced because of an illness, they're much more likely to make a decision and to make a decision that will keep them at least satisfied.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. And as we prepare to gather around the Thanksgiving table, we're having a conversation about the conversation, about the joys and the challenges of helping our aging family members, and about how to make it all manageable, loving, even rewarding. You can join the conversation. Are you part of the sandwich generation, taking care of your children and your parents? Are you elderly, maybe reaching a point where you need help? Is it hard to ask? My guests are Katie McGinnis Dietrich. She's chair of the Older Adults and Families Concentration at the Boston College of Social Work, and Ann Kaiser Stearns, author of the new book called Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. And we're taking your calls, so let's go to them right now. Arlene is calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Arlene. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. My question mostly is to deal with how to handle siblings who are not involved in the day-to-day care of the elderly parents and think that they know what's best, I guess is the way to put it. My mother has recently been in the hospital for a couple of months, having had a stroke, and I have my father who's still at home and wants to stay in his house. And I have siblings who think that it is just too challenging and too difficult to keep him at home and to deal with my mother in the hospital, and they want to move them from their home into some place that's, like an assisted living facility.
That's right, and that's an idea with which you disagree.
Well, yeah, I've been dealing with my parents daily. I mean, I've been the one that's been there, and I know what their desires are and their wishes are, but I'm having to fight for them, for my parents.
Got it. Well, Arlene, I wish you the best, and I'm going to put this issue to our guests in the studio. Ann Kaiser Stearns, interesting to me that the first two calls we've had revolve around this issue of siblings not agreeing on what to do. What do you recommend?
Exactly, and that really emphasizes the point of not talking about these thorny tough issues during holidays when we're trying to create moments of joy. I'd like to say something both to Arlene and to Bill, and that is that this is a perfect illustration of why one thing that should be included at Thanksgiving is a toast or a prayer or a celebration to say thank you to the caregiver. This person, you know, Arlene has been a caregiver, and Bill was, and they're both trying, and they both have the experience of trying to communicate to their family member and advocate for their parents, which is very tough and needs to be celebrated and honored. So I'm hoping that we'll thank our caregivers and we'll listen to their concerns as we come together for holidays.
Sounds like a good idea, and one that the caregivers especially would appreciate. Let me introduce another voice into this conversation. In the studio with me here in Boston is Tian Tang. She's pursuing a master's degree in social work at Simmons College in Boston. Until very recently, she was a care advisor with Springwell Incorporated, which provides state-subsidized home care services for the elderly. So she knows about helping the elderly and their caregivers and understands that it can be a complicated job. And Tian Tang, good to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, jump right in here. You've heard these two callers that have raised this issue of disagreeing siblings and sort of how to navigate what to do to care for an elderly parent. What do you think? How does your experience guide you on this thorny issue?
I think that the first thing is to talk to the elder directly, you know, see what they want for the rest of their life, you know, what aspects of their current life is most important to them to keep. You know, it's about the elder. And so I think if the family can listen to the elder and, you know, take what they want into consideration, of course, there are safety things that they need to consider as well. But the most important thing is to listen to,
right,
you know, who you're caring for.
In terms of siblings not being on the same page, is this something you encountered in your work on a regular basis or a somewhat regular basis?
Yes, definitely. I've had caregivers who the main caregiver is, you know, down the street, and then there are other caregivers in other states, and they do have a lot of input into, you know, what they want to see for their parents. And what I would just say to the main caregiver is to just advocate for the elder, you know, tell them what the day-to-day life is like, you know, try to help them to understand what exactly they're going through.
Katie McInnes-Dittrich, what were you hearing?
And a couple of things going on here is I think people need to remember that oftentimes when taking care of an older parent, there's a recreation of family dynamics for an entire life.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that you have grown up and you have separated and you've gone and had your own families, but you haven't changed the dynamics often of your family of origin. So therefore, the bossy one becomes the bossy one later. That I don't want to deal with it becomes the I don't want to deal with it. Again, we recreate those kinds of family roles, so people at least need to recognize that. I'm also a big fan of having a family meeting with the older adults there. There may be topics that the adult children need to handle, so that everybody can hear from the older adults at the same time. They're expressing their wishes about what they want and what's important to them, as opposed to feeling like everything got filtered through another sibling. So I think that's very important to understand that those family dynamics will get in the way of any decision making.
All right, let's go back to the phones and go to Diane, who's calling from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Diane, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. As soon as I heard this topic, and I tell you, it's a wonderful topic, I thought of my own situation. My dad passed a month ago. My mother passed about 5 years ago, and it was all about the siblings. And, you know, because there was such a disagreement about what should happen and how it should happen. When my dad passed, it's like my family of origin passed as well. The siblings aren't even speaking anymore. My mother had dementia. My dad couldn't take care of her. And to the point about the family dynamics going back in time, one of my siblings and I had this power struggle. She didn't want my mother to go in a nursing home. I was afraid for my dad's overall health, and she just walked away from the process, and it kind of recreated itself when my dad became ill. So I guess to the point here, it's very important, I think, for the siblings to be mature and look at the parent in terms of what the parent's needs are and try to step away from those roles. And if they need third parties to intercede, like a mediator or an attorney or whatever it needs to be. And in my particular case, when we were discussing assisted living for my father when he was failing, one of my other siblings says, well, he doesn't want it, he can't afford it. She had no clue what the financial ramifications were.
Diane, you've put a lot of, I really appreciate you calling and telling your story. You've put a lot of issues on the table. I want to get to the financial part of this as well. But here in the studio, Tian Tang and Katie McInnes-Dietrich were nodding their heads listening to you. Tian, I'll
and
start
I'm
with
you. And I'm nodding
you.
My head, too. Yeah. That was beautifully put.
Well, let me get all three of you to sort of respond to that call. I'll start with you, Tian Tang. What did you hear there?
I think what you see a lot with elder care is that if they require a lot of elder care, like 24/7, a lot of times, you know, the elder has to dip into their own savings. Family members have to dip in their own savings. So it's important to take a look at their finances early on, see what they can afford, what they can't afford, look into community resources that are available, such as Springwell that provides state-subsidized home care services, and just try to plan for the future.
Right, right. You know, Ann Kaiser-Stearns, in terms of the finances of this, I was looking at a report. Actually, I've got it right in front of me from the AARP. The percentage of annual costs borne by caregivers is something like $7,000 a year, nearly 20% of their income in out-of-pocket expenses is related to caregiving. That's quite a strain for a lot of folks, right?
Well, and we're talking $7,000 a month in terms of assisted living places. I'd like to say something, though, about those siblings.
Yeah,
I
go
remember
ahead.
Going through all of that. And here's what I used to do with your social worker guest who's just right on in talking about how all those family dynamics from when we were children come forth however old we are when we come deal with our parents. The two things I would recommend when families get together and your siblings are driving you crazy is exercise. Get out, go for walks, go to the gym, do something physical. When we are under stress and struggling to deal with all the old issues of long ago, nothing helps more than exercise. The second thing that helps is get in touch with people that you can talk with. I would go to Oklahoma when my siblings were there and all of these things were happening, and I would call my friends back in Baltimore, and I could rant and rave and say anything I wanted to about being the baby in the family and how my siblings were treating me like I was a baby still, and I was, you know, 60. And so you got to deal with your emotion, and you've got to be involved in motion. Those two things are the way to deal with stress, and it helps us manage the problems so we can talk like respectful, caring people to our elderly loved one and be warm with them, and we can also get along with our siblings.
Right. So a little bit of self-care, it sounds like you're
absolutely
recommending.
Yeah. A lot of self-care.
Right. Interesting. Let's go to the call to the phones again. Zachary is calling from Austin, Texas. Zachary, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I think I kind of have a different perspective on this because I work in a hospice. I'm a hospice liaison, a patient advocate. And I think one of the things that I really want to get across in this conversation is in making sure that people know what resources are available to them. The average hospice patient lives about 7 days before they come on service. And the vast majority of those people that I speak to, the families afterwards, feel like that if they would have known the resources that were out there, the help and assistance that a hospice can provide both the family and the patient, they would have gotten on months before.
Hmm.
The stigma that comes along with what we do in hospice, I mean, people assume that it's just for the last, you know, couple days of someone's life is just incorrect. And I think if we could rename hospice just more help, more assistance, more medical and medicinal supervision, more assistance for the family, for the people at home, whether they're in an acute setting, a skilled setting, or again, home, it can really help bridge the gap.
Zachary, I'm really glad you put this issue on the table. And from the perspective of a hospice liaison like yourself, I mean, when do you recommend families make contact with you?
Well, the sooner the better. First of all, hospice, to qualify for hospice, you need to have a terminal illness and a decline. So So people can be on hospice for years. They get recertified at certain increments with a doctor. I think that starting the conversation, you know, the earlier the better, because it's all, my job is all about making sure people don't make decisions without knowing what their options are. And in doing that, I can save people the regret of looking back and saying, I wish I would have, I wish this would have been better. So really, you know, if a person has a terminal illness, that's the time to start educating yourself about what it is you can do to help that family member moving forward. And whether hospice is the right move for that family at any given time or not is kind of mute, because at least they'll know. At least they'll know what their options are, and they'll be able to move forward educated.
Well, Zachary, great point. Thank you for bringing it to our attention and putting it on the table. And to my guests here in Boston and in Baltimore, you know, one of the big themes there, Katie McGinnis-Dietrich, I'll start with you, is just how important it is to understand what resources are out there in all of the issues that we're talking about.
Oh, definitely. And one of the big challenges is that most of the time when people are taking care of older families, it's the first time they've come in contact with the service system.
Right.
So they don't even know where to start. You know, they have not needed to use perhaps sophisticated health services or any social services. So they don't even know what's out there. So I would recommend, I'm making a recommendation for a resource right now that's available in all 50 states and the territories. It's www.eldercare.gov, and that is run by the Department of Health and Human Services. You go to that website, you put in your zip code, you identify what you want, and it will direct you to a service in your area. And the United States is covered. Every inch of the United States is covered by some access to either aging services access point, an area agency on aging, or in some states they're called aging and disability resource centers. That is your absolute place to start.
So I'm going to just repeat that, eldercare.gov.
Correct.
Okay, we're going to put a lot of these ideas and resources on our website at onpointradio.org, but sounds like a great recommendation there. Let's go to Debbie, who's calling from Southington, Connecticut. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well. What's on your mind?
So my mother lives alone in her own home in a different state than where I live, and I'm an only child. So figuring out when she's going to need assistance or when she's not safe alone in her own home anymore is pretty difficult from distance. And I'm sort of looking for some tips about how to make any of those decisions or how to even get information to assess her status.
Right. Well, a moment ago we heard about eldercare.gov, but Tian Tang, what can you tell Debbie?
I would say talk to, you know, your parent. You can be proactive. You can put in adaptive equipment to make bathing easier and more safe. There's plenty of check the home, you know, see if there's stairs in the home, see if there's an option to move your parent downstairs when that's needed. So I would just say, you know, if you're not sure if now is the time, talk to your mom. Try to plan for the future when the time is right.
Right. Ann Kaiser-Stearns, is there some advice you want to give Debbie?
Yes, I would say so much matters in terms of how we treat our elders with respect. No one wants to be forced to do anything, and older adults are not children. We need to treat them, even an impaired, cognitively impaired older adult. No one is a child as long as they live and they're an adult. I like what the Dalai Lama said, whenever possible, be kind. It is always possible.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like terrific universal advice. Katie, you know, in terms of helping Debbie out there, only child lives in a different state than her parent. What are you hearing?
One of the things I think that's helpful is if you really document how have things changed between visits, not just what the conversation is like. And if you're asking her, are you doing okay? Because believe me, they'll tell you they're doing okay. You know, they don't want to be a burden. They don't want their kids to worry about them. But if you can make observations between visits, that's always helpful to determine whether or not there's a decline.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a moment as we ready for Thanksgiving and the family gathering to talk about caring for our elderly relatives, how to navigate the financial and logistical challenges and to make it all manageable for everyone. You can join the conversation if you're elderly. What's the most important thing the younger generation should understand? And if you're caring for an elderly family member, what's the biggest challenge you're dealing with? My guests are Tian Tang, who has worked as a care advisor helping the elderly and their caregivers, and Kaiser Stearns, author of the new book called Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life, and Katie McGinnis-Dietrich, a social worker and professor at Boston College. And we're taking your calls. And let's go to Anne, who's calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air, and it's good to have you.
Thank you. Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. The reason I was calling, just last year, my mother passed, and it was extremely difficult. She got ill over a period of time, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. And luckily, my siblings and I, we get along pretty well. And however, I'm the only one without children, and she had, my mom had put into place what her wishes are, had designated myself as a healthcare proxy and my brother as a power of attorney. And thankfully, those plans really helped because the overwhelming feelings and despair of what was happening to her was so difficult to deal with. Although dealing with being a healthcare proxy was overwhelming. So it was such a difficult time. But if we hadn't had those plans, even though we knew what her wishes were, having them and having them in writing made such a difference.
Well, Anne, thank you for that. So a healthcare proxy, power of attorney, Tian Tang, that sounds like something incredibly important to put in place. But my guess is that not everybody does put it in place.
That's definitely true. Sometimes, you know, it's not in place until a crisis happens. And just like Katie was saying, that have these conversations when the elder can say what they want in their the rest of their life. You know, when they have the capacity to, you know, make their own decisions, have those conversations beforehand.
I want to come back to this subject of the financial burden of this. I mentioned this report from the AARP earlier that the average caregiver, sort of the unpaid family caregiver, spends an average of about $7,000 a year or nearly 20% of their income on out-of-pocket costs related to caregiving. There are also big impacts on the work front, Katie McGinnis-Dietrich. Can you address that and how caregivers are dealing with this?
Let me first say I'd offer my, you know, sympathies to the past caller because I know personally how difficult that is to lose an adult parent now that it's just a time when there is very, very confusing and overwhelming. But the point about how it affects work is that the caregiver absenteeism or caregiver illness or other types of special challenges to caregivers cost business $33 billion a year. And I think it's one of the things prompting those of us working in this field to really ask institutions to start responding to caregivers to either offer support, to offer flexible work schedules, to offer sick time, anything that would make that caregiving burden a little bit easier. And it's in business's best interest, which is when I believe they start to pay attention to it, is when it's costing in productivity. Because about 20% of every workforce today have people who are caregivers. Yeah. So this is not a small issue. It's a large one. So that responsiveness by, I think, corporate structures is also important.
Well, it's interesting. I want to read a comment by from a listener on Facebook. Karen writes, I was speaking with a colleague who lived in Dublin, Ireland for many years, where elderly people can ask help with housing, cleaning, and other services so elderly people can live in their homes longer and are supported. Again, I wonder why the U.S. can't look at solutions to problems which work for other countries. I wanted to read that because I wanted to ask, I'll start with you, Katie. I mean, how are we doing relative to other countries in this country in terms of providing support for folks?
There are lots of services. I think the United States is very competitive with other nations.
That's good to hear.
So I think we have learned a lot from it, and which is why it is so impressive that the United States is covered so completely by the Area Agency on Aging concept, and that you can go to a central thing as this eldercare.gov and find out what's available in your area. It just may not be visible to people, but there's a very developed service system that's out there. I think we may not do as well with end of life or alternatives, creative ways of doing it, but in terms of providing services for cleaning and health and transportation, in urban areas, I think it's way above average. In rural areas, maybe not so much, but actually, I think we're doing pretty well.
Let's take a few more calls. Mark is calling from Kannapolis, North Carolina. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I'm calling about intellectually disabled adults who most often nowadays they have jobs and will develop create a nest egg over time where, 40, 50 years ago, a lot of times they didn't work, but now they do. And a lot of our state laws are inadequate because they let the individual try and make their choices freely, free to get married and all these other things. But with the invention of the Internet, they meet a lot of predators online who are looking to take, whether they got $30 or $300 million, they're looking to take their money. And it becomes a challenge to the family members who realize what's going on to protect this individual from themselves because they make poor choices. And as they get older, you have to be there for them pretty much 24/7, where they are, protect them from predators who are online and want to, get married so they can get involved with them, that kind of stuff, because they know they have a job. But it's phenomenal that the laws, I think, are so far behind the times to help protect those individuals. And I understand giving them the freedoms, but you also have to protect them at the same time.
Mark, so it's an important point, and I'm glad you put it on the table. Ann Kaiser-Stearns, can you address that a little bit, just about this issue of competency on the part of some folks as they get older and how they might be challenged in terms of protecting them, their own interests?
Well, and also what I heard in Mark was the exasperation of the great responsibility of having to keep so many oranges in the air, mm-hmm. and having to you hear the concern and compassion in his voice. And it reminds me of the importance of saying to Mark and other caregivers, you have got to take care of yourself. We don't want John Henryism where the railroad builder hammered a steel drill into rock at such a fast pace that he won the race and then fell over dead against a steam-powered hammer. We've got to say, you've got to get care for yourself. I like to tell people it's important, if you can, to keep your own job. Because when you're dealing with being a caregiver and you're doing so much for somebody else under so much stress where you're powerless in many ways to change how that person is doing, you need a place to go where your self-esteem is raised because you can make a difference in the job you've done for years. You have a support community there at work. But we've got to tap into those resources. In my book, I have 21 pages of resources, and the .gov recommendation that was given earlier is the best place to start.
All right. Yes. Let's take another call. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for taking my call. A little different kind of point. I'm 76 years old, and for almost all my life, I was the youngest member of the family. Now I'm the only member of the family. All four of my brothers and their wives and my parents and my wife's parents and everybody are all gone. And having watched that and also watched a number of other episodes with friends, it's clear to me that one thing that's really missing in society is a way by which folks like myself, who are getting close to the end of the road, can get the proper chemicals or whatever to allow themselves to die in their own way, at their own time, in their own circumstances, with no interference from anybody that presumes to tell them what about how they should handle what I think is the most personal possible decision. I don't think any institution or government or any person has any right to interfere in my decision about when I want to die and how I want to go and where I want to go.
Well, Jim, I hear you, and I understand what you're talking about. I know a number of states have dealt with that issue. Katie McGinnis-Dietrich, what do you have to say to Jim about this issue?
Two things. I don't disagree that people have rights to make decisions that other people may not agree with. I think the reason that we found hesitancy in even going to a physician or medically assisted death is that we're very worried about vulnerable populations. We're very worried about older adults saying, I'm a bother. You know, I'm going to die anyway, so we might as well get this show on the road, when there have been cases where it would actually be unnecessary death. I mean, in situations at the end of life, clearly people will make different kinds of decisions. But I think those of us in the field are very concerned about protecting the vulnerable, the developmentally disabled as they get older, older adults who have dementia, so that there isn't the sort of accidental slide that happens with that. But I understand why he would feel the way that he does.
Yeah, and we appreciate the call in a big way. I want to read something from Alexandra, who wrote to us on Facebook. This is a slightly different subject, but it's an important one. I moved back from Europe to home care my elderly mother. I want people to know how rewarding this solution turned out to be. Although bedridden, Mom was not ill. We were fortunate to have hospice for 7 months paid by Medicare. She passed at 97 years old. The whole experience taught me death is not something to fear. I'm so glad we did not put her in a nursing home, which we could not have afforded anyway. Thanks for covering this important topic. Tian Teng, I'm wondering if you can sort of talk a little bit about that decision to home care elderly parents and what that is involved, because that was a really nice statement from Alexandra.
Yeah, I do find that a lot of caregivers do find that taking care of their parents at home is very rewarding, because that's what the elder wants. You know, it's very difficult for a elder to move from their house that they've stayed in for 40 plus years to a nursing home or to an assisted living where they're surrounded by strangers and not familiar with their environment. You find that elders do a lot better within their own environment.
Right. Well, let's take a couple more calls, at least as we move toward the end of the hour. Meg is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to address the two speakers about the timing of moving out of one's own home. Everybody, if asked, would really prefer to stay in their own home. I'm the oldest of nine children. My siblings and I, we all pretty much agree and get along very well. We don't have that issue. My mother always wanted to stay in her own home, but she's suffering from rapidly progressing dementia. We did have care in the home 5 days a week, and a brother of mine moved in with her, so then she did have somebody around the clock. But this was to the point of having to go to the bathroom with her. She was accidentally starting electrical fires. It was becoming a real hazard. And so we did move her into, we researched this, moved her into a beautiful facility, a very fluid environment, so you can move in and out of independent, assisted, skilled hospice. So there's, you know, wherever you need to go, you can move in and out of those very easily once you're into this facility. However, we missed the mark. We missed the timing of this. We didn't understand the whole dementia and issue, and she was not part of the decision. So she has never gotten on board with this is home now. It's a beautiful facility. Love the staff. I feel they have the Eden philosophy, if anybody wants to research that. A lot of facilities have that, apparently.
Well, Meg, you've put a great issue on the table, and I wish you and your mom all the best. Katie, I mean, Meg seems to be talking about a number of things there, but not having that conversation in time with her mom is a key point here.
And I think some of it is denial. I think some of it is the discomfort of having the conversation. But what we're really seeing in terms of patterns here is that oftentimes people think they wait too long. They stay at home for too long and think, well, now it's time for assisted living, when they have actually missed assisted living and they're ready for skilled nursing care. It's because they have so many needs. So I think having the conversation sooner, I mean, I think also one thing I used with my own mother, and I was a long distance caregiver, and And we ended up putting her in a nursing home, which was not what we wanted, but we had no choice. We didn't have those resources there to have someone coming in every day, was to simply say, humor me, Mom. Mm-hmm. I know. I said, I'm so far away. I worry about you all the time. You know, it. I would feel better if you could. And I know my mother sometimes just gave in, saying, okay, fine. So I'll let someone come in and clean 2 days a week. And, you know, because that it made me feel better. So I think the sooner you can have a conversation, the better before you need to do it. But I hear what she's saying about people wait too long and then people can't be part of the conversation.
You know, it just occurs to me. I mean, no, it doesn't just occur to me. I was thinking of this before the show, but I wanted to get this question in as our time runs out. This is an issue that it seems to me, when I say this issue, this whole set of questions around caring for an elder person is going to become more and more central to our society as more and more of us are living longer and longer lives. I mean, Katie, let me get you to sort of give a final thought on that.
I think what we're certainly seeing is that more people are living into their 90s than ever before because we can medically support people at that point. We're seeing a demographic shift as boomers now, their parents, the first part of the boomers' parents are already dead, and we're looking for middle ones. So I think the people living longer, having better medical care, and smaller families, because very few boomers had 8 or 9 or 10 kids.
All right. Have that conversation. Katie McGinnis-Dietrich, chair of the Older Adults and Families Concentration at Boston College School of Social Work, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Ann Kaiser Stearns, professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. Her new book is called Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Ann Kaiser Stearns, thank you.
Thank you.
And Tian Tang, very recently a care advisor with Springwell Incorporated. Thank you for coming in as well. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
This is it. That's it. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.